Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1978, nearly two-thirds of California voters passed Proposition 13, an initiative that slashed property taxes by about 60%. State and local governments were forced to cut funding across the board, and education was hit very hard. In 1978, California per pupil spending was 14th in the country. Today, it is near the very bottom of the list. Californians are about to vote on Proposition 15, which would create a split roll tax by reassessing properties owned by businesses. This would raise billions of dollars in new revenue for schools, community colleges, and local governments. We will get an update on Prop 15 later in the show. But first, we're going to talk about the history of Proposition 13, which is told and The First Angry Man. It's a new documentary telling the story of the anti-tax crusader Howard Jarvis and the beginning of the nationwide anti-government, anti-tax movement. Here is a trailer for the new documentary, The First Angry Man.
Howard Jarvis certainly doesn't look like a man who has every established politician in the state scared to death, but he does.
Jarvis was an eccentric.
He was described as a crank, a kook.
Howard Jarvis was angry.
We got a lot of marinated bureaucrats in government, and they are on a big gravy train.
Just like the language of Donald Trump.
I don't give a damn what they think about what I say.
Really reminded me of that.
He was fed up with politicians and government bureaucrats. But most of all, he hated taxes.
The government has far too much money at every level. There's enough to float this state in the Pacific Ocean on $100 bills.
Howard Jarvis would lead an anti-government crusade that ushered in a radical new vision of society.
With no love, there it is.
Howard Jarvis and the Prop 13 campaign swept across the nation like wildfire.
Long after he left the scene, the movement he started would dominate American politics.
Read my lips.
The era of big government is over.
Giving rise to a new era of unfettered wealth at the top and austerity at the bottom, the era of the tax revolt.
And that is the trailer for the new documentary, The First Angry Man. If you are in the Bay Area, you can watch the film on KQED on October 16th at 8 p.m. And you can find more information about the film at yourcallradio.org. Joining us now are the filmmakers. Camille Servan-Schreiber is producer of The First Angry Man, and Jason Cohn is director of The First Angry Man. Hi, Camille and Jason. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Your timing could not be better, given that Prop 15 is on the ballot, which would change how commercial property taxes are calculated. Camille, did you time this just right? Were you following the signature gathering campaign for Prop 15?
Well, we absolutely have been following it, but we've been working on this film for almost a decade, so I can't say that we timed it for that at all.
Oh, wow, a decade.
Almost, yes.
That's amazing.
It's been a long time.
Wow. Well, thank you for all the work that you put into it. It really is a really great film. Jason, 10 years on this film. Why did you decide to dedicate 10 years of your life to telling us about the history of Prop 13?
Well, it did take 10 years to make the film, but obviously we weren't working on it, full time the whole time. There were long periods where we weren't really paying much attention to it, but we got interested in it, when California was falling apart. You remember there was a period around a decade ago when the country was on the verge of bankruptcy. And that's what got us asking these questions about what happened to California.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me in the film is some of the footage you have about women who were, you know, housewives at the time, they use that term, who were who saw their property taxes go up so high, and they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to pay it. It was just really interesting footage to watch these women who said that they'd never been involved in politics before. And all of a sudden, they gathered in kitchen tables, mostly in Southern California, and started educating people about this. Camille, can you tell us more about that and how you were able to find that footage?
Well, we searched far and wide to find all the footage that was there. I mean, it was another time. I mean, one of my favorite moment where one of these women is outraged when she finds out about her property taxes that just rose. She's saying, where is my husband going to get more money to pay this? Like, it's not even an option for her to be working. So times have changed quite a bit. But we, you know, it was a social movement that really was started by mostly white and older Americans. There were many women indeed. But there were a lot of people who were older, who were on fixed income, the people who were most at risk of finding themselves too stretched to be able to stay in their homes where they had been for their whole lives, were primarily older Americans, men and women.
Jason, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, it was a moment in California in particular, although I think that similar things were happening in other states around the country, where inflation was pushing up the price of homes. And the way that property taxes worked, at least in California, was you were taxed based on the assessed value of your home, and the assessments happened every few years. And as inflation was pushing up the price of your home, if the local assessors didn't change the rates, which usually they wouldn't do it, they wouldn't really lower the rates, they would keep them the same, then your property taxes would keep going up and up. And so you had a situation where the amount of money that people on fixed incomes were being asked to pay for their homes was going up faster than they could afford to pay for it. And at least apocryphally, there were, you know, stories about people getting taxed out of their homes. You know, the sort of, you know, little old lady from Pasadena who was on a fixed income, you know, maybe a widow, and you know, had to choose between, you know, selling her house and, you know, paying for the other things in her life. And that kind of became the media story, at least. It's not really clear how many actual cases there were of that, but what is clear is that it was causing a lot of strain, and it was, you know, one of the biggest issues in the state at the time. It was when Jerry Brown came into office in, first term as governor in California. He had, you know, sworn to address it. He recognized it as sort of the biggest problem facing a lot of people. But the legislature and the governor were not really successful in addressing it. And as a result, these, you know, normal taxpayers, like those women sitting on the floor stuffing envelopes that you saw in the film, they got together and started to try to solve the problem themselves. And it was Howard Jarvis, who was the person who was able to sort of galvanize all of these small organizations of taxpayers around the state, and turn them into a movement.
It was interesting to learn so much about Howard Jarvis. In the film, we learned that he moved to Los Angeles in the 1930s. He connected with the fringe of the right wing in Southern California. He ran for U.S. Senator in California in 1962 on a very angry anti-government message, but he failed very badly in the primaries. It was also interesting, Camille, to learn that Howard Jarvis, you know, talked about himself as a Los Angeles businessman, but as you point out in the film, he was actually a paid lobbyist for Los Angeles apartment building owners.
That's right. He was not that much of a businessman after all, and he was a paid lobbyist for apartment building owners, which of course, made it in his interest to have something to do with Prop 13. I mean, he had been, he had spent many years trying to get elected and trying to put something like this on the ballot, and had failed multiple times. And then finally in 1978, he found that was his time.
Yeah, what I find really interesting is that in 1962, when he ran for Senate in California, very much a dark horse race. He was trying to unseat a sitting Republican senator, and he challenged him in the primary from the right. And most of his campaign was based on, anti-communism. It was, the Cold War and all of that. And he was basically running a whisper campaign against another Republican, saying that he was soft on communism. And there were, hints that maybe he was homosexual. And it was a kind of a dirty campaign. But during the process of campaigning, what Jarvis did is he went, out into the more rural districts. He traveled all over California, and he talked to people, and he found that, of course people were interested in communism. It was 1962 after all, but the issue that he found that really resonated with people was this tax issue, especially outside of the cities. And so from 1962, he really started focusing fairly single-mindedly on this issue of lowering taxes, the property tax and state income taxes. He ran for tax assessor. He ran for mayor in Los Angeles at one point on the tax issue. And he was really never successful at anything. Like he failed repeatedly in all of his efforts. Until at the age of 75, sort of a perfect storm of events came together, and he managed to get enough signatures on the ballot for Proposition 13 in 1978.
And he needed just under 500,000 signatures to get Prop 13 on the ballot, and he actually got three times that.
Yeah, it was more signatures than anyone had ever put together for a ballot initiative in California. And I'm pretty sure that he did it without paying for, signature gatherers. It was all volunteers. So it's, there are some people who say that it wasn't really a grassroots effort. There's a lot of money involved, but I would dispute that. I think there was a lot of grassroots energy, behind the property tax revolt in 78.
But it was a watershed proposition campaign. It's one that energized in a way that no proposition had before. There was more money poured into that campaign than there had been before. So it really was. It's one of the things that is interesting about this particular campaign and why we looked at it so closely.
Well, if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about the history of Prop 13. If you remember the campaign and then what happened after it passed, especially to education, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then later in the show, we'll talk more about Proposition 15. Today, we are joined by Camille Servan-Schreiber, producer of the documentary, The First Angry Man. Jason Cohn is director of The First Angry Man. It takes a look at the anti-tax crusader Howard Jarvis and Prop 13. If you're in the Bay Area, you can watch the film on KQED on October 16th at 8 p.m. It seems like what was happening is you had a lot of mostly white homeowners who said, we cannot pay these growing property taxes. At the same time, Howard Jarvis used some of the same racist language, xenophobic language that Trump uses about immigrants, saying things like, quote, these people are getting too much of my money, talking about the growing Latino population in California. And then he also, did something in 1978. He began pushing LA County to release property tax assessments early. So that was, so people were able to see their amounts that continually increased. So Camille, there were several things going on at the same time here.
I mean, one thing to sort of put a frame around all of this is this was a time where people's perception of government and how they felt about government was really changing. I mean, one of the reasons Jarvis had been so unsuccessful in the 60s is that at the time, people really believed in government and that government was helping them out and doing, and mostly doing good. And by the time you get to the late 70s, that had changed quite substantially. And so there were a lot of other forces at play.
Yeah, I mean, you have the Vietnam War, you have Watergate, you know, which obviously changed perceptions about government. But, you know, one thing that we wanted to focus on is the fact that race was a big part of the conversation at the time around taxation and the role of government. That in, you know, previous years, the government had started to really focus on civil rights, on creating, you know, racial equality, social equality through programs like affirmative action and fair housing, you know, these kind of issues. And that kind of changed how some white people felt about government and about how their taxes were being spent. And that all kind of played into, you know, how people felt about their taxes. In Southern California in particular, you know, you had people who started to feel that the money that they were paying on taxes for schools, for example, it wasn't going for their neighborhood schools anymore. They were worried that the money was being shipped across town to schools that were, you know, primarily Latino or African American. And so, you know, you have sort of white suburban families or white suburban taxpayers in the San Fernando Valley or in Orange County, for example, who, you know, they might have been perfectly happy to pay their, you know, fairly high property taxes when they felt that it was their neighborhood schools which were being funded by it. But sort of the change in how they perceived government and what government was doing with their money was changing how they viewed the whole picture. And that was really, you know, I think an important part of what happened with Prop 13.
You also explore how the anti-busing movement connected with the anti-tax movement in California.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think these were two issues that happened right at the same time, kind of on top of each other. The movement, you know, which is to say the property tax revolt and the anti-busing movement kind of joined forces. The leaders endorsed each other's movements, and it was viewed as sort of a classic example of government kind of social engineering a solution to the race problem in a way that was beneficial to African Americans and Latinos, but was hurtful to, you know, white families. I mean, I think that the two issues kind of wrapped together in a sense and, you know, supported each other. It was just sort of, it was part of that whole picture of how government was viewed as, you know, working for people of color, but no longer for these sort of white middle class families in the suburbs. And, you know, that affected how people viewed the government. And when your view of government sours, then your view of taxation, of, you know, the taxes you pay, that sours too.
Right. Camille, it was interesting also to learn more about how politicians in some cases were well, not necessarily blindsided by this, but Jerry Brown at the time told the legislator to reform property taxes and put it on his desk, but politicians just couldn't agree. So it fell on Jerry Brown, who in some ways was really caught by surprise. Why didn't Democrats do more to say, okay, we understand that, you know, we're talking about homes that were bought for $15,000, $20,000 at the time, and then they go up in value, and the property taxes go up in value, and a lot of people cannot afford that. So why didn't they try harder to push for some sort of homeowner tax reform, but not to, to keep the big business tax separate from that?
That would have made so much sense, right? But they, you know, Jason can speak better to this than I can, but it is amazing to me how much what's interesting is that they really tried. They were aware it was a problem. I don't think they quite realized how bad it was. And the problem was particularly acute in Southern California, a little further away from Sacramento. And I don't think they quite understood the level of, anger and motivation that these taxpayers had, but they did. They tried to pass things in the legislature and just couldn't get it together. And then Prop 13 came along. But Jason is better at telling that part of the story.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Kemi said. The Democrats certainly had everything that they needed to fix the problem, at least on a temporary basis. You know, not only did they have both houses of the legislature, both chambers of the legislature, but they had the governor, Jerry Brown, and they had a very large cash surplus in order, which they could have used to provide tax relief to homeowners. And, you know, as you pointed out, there are many ways that they could have kind of structured tax relief so that the people who needed it the most got it, you know, thresholds for income, or they could have done it, you know, based on age, or, you know, there are many ways that it could have been done. And many proposals, you know, went through the legislature, and none of them came out, essentially. And meanwhile, Howard Jarvis and his partner, Paul Gann, were gathering hundreds of thousands of signatures to put this measure on the ballot for voters to decide for themselves. And what they did was they just, you know, kind of, instead of trying to come up with a complicated formula with, you know, to provide some relief to some people, but make sure that other people who could afford to pay it would, you know, would continue to pay taxes, they just used this, you know, real blunt instrument approach, kind of a machete approach, and they just said all real estate, all real property in California will be, you know, taxed at this low base, the 1975 base, and it will be 1%, and it can't increase by more than 2% every year. It was a blunt instrument approach. And, you know, in the end, when voters are looking at, you know, a ballot initiative, they don't want to have to read, you know, 500 words and make sense of sort of complicated stuff. They liked what they saw because it was so simple and easy to understand. And, you know, the fact that, you know, big corporations like Disney, for example, or, you know, Pacific Gas and Electric, which have, you know, lots of property, that they were going to benefit from this. The voters didn't really care so much that rich corporations or wealthy Californians were going to benefit as well. What they cared about was that they, meaning, you know, the taxpayer who's in the voting booth, that their taxes were going to go down.
Right.
And, you know, I think that, you know, simplicity was a tool that they used very well in that campaign.
And the effects were immediate, with local governments cutting funding across the board. And as we all know, education has been hit very hard. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I'm just curious about, and I don't know if your guests would know this, how many billions of dollars have been lost to the state as a result of Prop 13, which now Jarvis is still trying to do again. Everybody, I'm sure, in the state has gotten these pamphlets from Jarvis proposing to continue Prop 13. And I just want to say one thing that you've commented on. You know, the Democrats in this state, and I've been a lifelong Democrat, but now I'm an independent, and they have really let the people of this state down time and time and time again. And I just want to bring up one issue that's related to this tax issue, and that is, this came up in one of the conversations in an earlier program, Rose, that you brought up, and it was that in order to try and fill the gap, the deficit that the state is now incurring from the COVID and the fires and everything else, there was an attempt, I believe, by an assemblyman, I think his name might have been Santiago, to try and get a millionaire's tax in the state of California. That didn't even get out of committee. That thing failed to get out of the committee, and that could have really made a big difference in terms of how the state could have dealt with the deficit. So once again, the Democrats fail, and it's really a shame that the corporate Democrats have done this for decades. So anyway, that's the way things go, and I'm hoping people will vote against this proposition.
Thank you for that, Greg. To Greg's point, Tom Amiano posted on social media, a former politician, the loophole that allows banks and big businesses to not be reassessed was supported by then Speaker Willie Brown. Camille, can you answer Greg's first question about how many billions were lost because of this?
I think I could probably answer that, actually. Yeah. So in 1978, when it passed, the estimate was $6 or $7 billion a year. Obviously, that's, you know, 1978 dollars. I don't know, you know, what that is in today's dollars or how much it is today. But obviously, it's a lot of money. And you know, California at the time had a very significant budget surplus, somewhere in that area, $6 or $7 billion, I think. And so what happened after Prop 13 passed was Jerry Brown and the legislature basically backfilled with the surplus from previous years. They backfilled the, you know, the local county budgets and municipal budgets, so that in the initial years after Prop 13, there wasn't that much pain felt. You know, we didn't have to make too many sacrifices. I think we, you know, anecdotally, school districts might have, you know, closed down summer schools and things like that. But the cuts did not have to be very deep for a number of years because of the surplus. But certainly by the, you know, late 1980s, early 1990s, we had really chronic budget crises in California, and you know, to the point where California was on the verge of bankruptcy. You know, we were furloughing workers. We were shortening the school year. We have really cut it very close in California. And you know, I think we all see it, you know, in terms of the state of our infrastructure, you know, the ability to deal with problems like homelessness and the lack of availability of affordable housing. You know, so many problems that California has that we just simply don't have the resources to deal with.
As someone points out in the film, in 1978, California spending per pupil was 14th in the country. After Prop 13 passed, it fell to 26. We are now at number 43. Camille, what else stood out for you when you looked at the effects that Prop 13 had?
You know, there were so many effects in California, and I think we're actually all quite familiar with them. Infrastructure, the schools, all of that are things that sadly we've become used to thinking about and naming. What was really interesting to me was how this proposition became a model and an example all around the country, and that many, many other states passed the propositions or laws that were equivalent. And it really launched this national tax revolt where the entire country became engulfed in this movement of let's cut taxes and stop paying for many things. And California is not doing, the schools of California are not doing well now. But if you look at the country at large, they're not doing great either. So I think, you know, the magnitude of the problem that Prop 13 unleashed on the country is what blew my mind, really, in doing this this research.
Hmm. As you point out, Reagan supported Prop 13. He made the California tax revolt a central part of his bid in 1980. And then Grover Norquist saw this as a roadmap to Republican success. The United States hasn't had a Republican vote for tax increases since 1990. Republicans have to take anti-tax pledges or possibly lose their election bid.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that, you know, prior to 1978, taxes were not really so much a partisan issue. You know, you had Republicans who would be for taxes, and you had Democrats who would be against taxes. And this time period is where it became sort of the defining, one of the, like, truly defining partisan issues in the country. And I think that that's really a problem, you know, because there are good taxes and there are bad taxes. And when it's completely defined according to sort of partisan identification, the country really loses a lot of nuance in terms of deciding, you know, what is reasonable and sane tax policy. But it really happened around that time. I think it's been, you know, really to the detriment of the whole country.
Hmm. Let's take one more caller. Let's hear from Starchild. Hi, Starchild. Welcome to the show. Do we have Starchild? Oh, I think we lost Starchild. All right. Well, if you're still there, we're still going to talk about this. We're having some technical problems, so maybe that was the issue. I want to thank both of you for joining us. For people who do not live in the Bay Area, will there be other opportunities for them to watch this film?
Yes.
Actually, it will air in Southern California in KCET next week as well. It's going to be on Tuesday, the 13th at 7 p.m. And the film is also available on iTunes and Amazon. It's The First Angry Man. So you can watch it whether on broadcast or elsewhere.
Okay, great. So it is available online. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, it's also being picked up by other PBS stations across the country. We're just starting to find out about those now, but we'll post those on our website at firstangryman.com.
Okay, fantastic. Camille Servan-Schreiber is producer of The First Angry Man. Jason Cohn is director of The First Angry Man. Thank you so much for putting 10 years of your life into this movie, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a quick break, we will talk about California's Proposition 15. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about Proposition 15, which would change the rules of California Prop 13 by reassessing property taxes on commercial properties. If Prop 15 passes, it would raise up to $11.5 billion starting in 2025, with 60% going to cities and counties, 40% going to schools and community colleges. Prop 15 does not apply to homeowners, farmland, or businesses with under $3 million in property. Proposition 15 is being financed largely by the California Teachers Association, the SEIU California, and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. They've spent a whopping $48 million so far. Supporters also include the California Democratic Party, Joe Biden, and California Governor Gavin Newsom. Those opposed to Prop 15 have spent a whopping $38 million so far. Major donors include the California Business Roundtable, the California Business Properties Association, and the California Taxpayers Association. Those opposed also include the California Chamber of Commerce, the California Retailers Association, and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Joining us now to talk about Prop 15 is Tim Redmond. He's been a political and investigative reporter in San Francisco for more than 30 years, much of that time as executive editor of the Bay Guardian. He is founder of 48 Hills. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you, Tim. You have written so much about taxes and inequality, and I just want to get your overall thoughts about how Prop 13 has really shaped where California is today. So much inequality over the last four decades.
Oh, it's incredible the impact that Prop 13 has had. For starters, in 1977, before Prop 13, commercial property, big commercial property, paid the vast majority of the property taxes in California, something around 70% of the overall tax burden. That has flipped. Now the overall tax burden falls overwhelmingly on homeowners. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I know your guests talked about what Prop 13 did, but residential property turns over faster than commercial property, of course, and commercial property, there's a lot of ways to sell commercial property without actually selling it and triggering a transfer. So, for example, Donald Trump is part owner of the Bank of America building in San Francisco, along with a real estate investment trust based in New York City. But Donald Trump's name doesn't appear on it. It's owned by something called 555 California Interests LLC or something like that, all right? It's owned by an LLC. Now, theoretically, Donald Trump could simply sell his shares in the LLC to someone else, and it would still be owned by 555 California something LLC, and there would have been a transfer in ownership, but it wouldn't necessarily trigger a reassessment. So there's all kinds of tricks that have been played to make sure that the big commercial properties never get reassessed under Prop 13. And this is costing us a lot of money. My research that I did with a couple of interns this summer shows that the 55 largest buildings in San Francisco, the largest commercial office buildings in San Francisco, just 55 buildings out of 400, have cost the city $360 million a year in escaped taxes because of the way Prop 13 works. So what Prop 15 would do is address that purely for the big commercial properties. It, you know, there's a lot of scare tactics going on, but the fact is this will not affect homeowners at all. It does not affect residential property. It affects only commercial property. And commercial property, as I say, has been escaping its share of the tax burden in California for a long, long time.
So for the example you gave about the building that is owned by Donald Trump and a real estate investment partner, Vornado Realty Trust. You report that because of Prop 13, Trump and Vornado are paying just over $11 million a year less in local property taxes than they would be if the building were assessed at its true value. So over the past 14 years, they've escaped about $164 million in San Francisco taxes.
Yes, and when you look at economic equity and fairness, you know, Donald Trump's tax returns are suggesting he's not as rich as he was, as everyone thought he was. But nevertheless, these are folks who can afford to pay taxes. Donald Trump paid less federal income taxes in the last 10 years than I did just last year, I think. And he can certainly afford to pay his fair share of taxes for San Francisco public schools and for the needs of the city. So we're talking about, essentially, these taxes will fall, 90% of the increased taxes will fall on maybe 10% of the property owners. It's the big folks. This is all this stuff about this is going to hurt small business, this is going to hurt this, this is going to hurt that. Not true. It's the big commercial property owners that are going to pay most of this. And they're, as I say, they're folks who can afford to do it, and they're folks who have been escaping, getting away with hundreds of millions of dollars in lower taxes because of Prop 13.
So this will not apply to homeowners, farmland, or businesses with under $3 million in property. And the people who are opposed to Prop 15, They say that if you raise property taxes, it is going to trickle down to, say, the renter or the small business. And we have a question about that, and then we'll get you to respond, Tim. Let's go to Suzanne in Oakland. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, all. My question is, how does this apply to small landlords, especially those who have one rental unit and they live in the other unit of their house?
So, again, it's businesses with under $3 million in property. What does that mean exactly, Tim?
Well, it's you're talking about residential property anyway. You're talking about a landlord who has one building and rents out the other unit. That's residential property. That's not affected.
Not at all, Tim?
No, that's not. It's a residential unit with a landlord and a person living downstairs. No, that's not going to be affected by this at all.
Thank the Lord for that. Oh, my God. I am so grateful. I've been worried and worried and worried about this. I thought I was going to have to withdraw from the rental market and kick out the tenants.
No, Prop 15 will not cause you to do that, no.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that. And thank you, radio station. I'm glad you're covering this. Nobody else is.
Well, thank you. And we have a lot of propositions on the ballot, and you can find our election briefs at kalw.org. Thank you for that question, Suzanne. Let's go next to Starchild. Starchild, are you with us? Do we have Starchild? Oh, okay. Starchild hung up. All right. Sorry about that. I thought we had you back. Tim, so let's just talk about the facts here. Who, again, we're, as you told Suzanne, this is not going to apply to homeowners. What about the big property owners, like the Veritases, for example?
It's, you know, in a perfect world, we would tax Veritas highly because of the way California tax law works. You can't just tax, I mean, I suppose you could, but it would be difficult to just tax big landlords and not tax small landlords. So this applies to commercial property, not residential property. If there's people living there, if it's residential property, it's not impacted. And, you know, let's remember, in terms of the big landlords, I'm sure your prior guests talked about this. I only tuned in partway through, but Prop 13 passed in California. The idea that one of the selling points of Prop 13 was landlords are going to pass the tax savings onto their tenants. And that never happened, right? The folks who are talking about small businesses facing rent increases, there's been a lot of studies on this. And the studies show that rents in commercial buildings tend to be based on market value, on what you can get. And right now, commercial property, I mean, tenants of commercial properties right now are going to find when their leases are up that landlords are desperate to rent commercial property right now because of COVID. That, of course, will change after the pandemic. But the fact is, the studies have shown consistently that property taxes do not have a significant impact on rents for small businesses and commercial property.
Because that's one of their biggest claims.
It's absolutely one of their biggest claims. But also, let's be realistic here. The vast majority of this will be paid by the largest commercial landlords. And let's just take Donald Trump's building for a second. You know, I haven't looked at the listings in a couple of years. But the last time I looked, there weren't any small businesses in the Bank of America building. There weren't any struggling mom and pop stores in the Bank of America building. These are big finance, insurance, real estate, tech companies. That even if their rent did go up, you know, let's take the building on Market Street where Twitter is. All right. That building will be reassessed. That building, when it was converted from a furniture warehouse to Twitter's headquarters, the owners saved $25 million in fees that should have gone to the city through a loophole in law converting the property from warehouse to office space. That is one of the biggest landlords in San Francisco. And Twitter obviously is a large company with a lot of money. If Twitter's rent goes up a little bit, they can afford it. If the Shorenstein company has to pay a little bit more in property taxes, they can afford it. So this really, this whole thing about small businesses is just, it's just a misleading talking point that they're trying to use to scare people into voting no.
Tim, I remember this major study came out in 2012. It's, oh gosh, already been 8 years. High tech, low tax, how the richest Silicon Valley corporations pay incredibly low taxes on their land. The report was prepared by the California Tax Reform Association with funding by the Bonet Foundation. And they looked at all these tech companies. For example, Intel sits on 36 acres of centrally located land taxed at 2 cents a square foot. IBM pays $202 an acre on 200 acres of land. By way of comparison, land bought by Google generates $1.35 in tax per square foot. So these are major, major differences here when you look at the older tech companies versus the newer tech companies.
Well, yes, that's the problem with Prop 13. I mean, the problem with Prop 13 is that if you have property that you've owned for a long time, like Intel has owned that property for a long time, your taxes are way lower than somebody who buys a piece of property last week. I mean, this obviously happens with residential property too. If you have owned a house in San Francisco for 30 years, your property taxes are way lower than someone who bought the exact same size house last year. But it's particularly striking when you look at these big tech companies in Silicon Valley and the extraordinarily low property taxes that they're paying. And, you know, Prop 15 would allow that property to be assessed at its fair value, at its fair market value.
We're talking about a lot of money here because Intel is paying $980 an acre, whereas Google is paying $58,000 an acre. Major, major, yes. Major difference.
We're talking about a lot of money, and that money is going to go to public schools and communities whose budgets are really taking a hit from COVID. And, you know, your prior guests were right when they're talking about the hit on the public schools in California. It's just been astonishing. This idea that we can reassess big commercial properties, people who have lots of money, and put some of that money into public education and into community needs is, you know, it would dramatically change California. I mean, we're talking about $10 billion a year, maybe $12 billion a year, depending. It'll change a little year to year. We're talking about very, very large amounts of money. You know, in San Francisco alone, you could practically double the San Francisco Unified School District budget. Wow. With the money that we are potentially getting here. It's not surprising that the California teachers are pushing this and that SEIU is pushing this. This would be potentially transformative for local government. This isn't also, by the way, money that's going to the state of California. It's going to local government.
That was the other question, Tim, because it would raise up to $11.5 billion starting in 2025, 40% going to schools and community colleges, 60% going to cities and counties, according to media outlets. Can you tell us what that means exactly, the 60% and the 40%?
Yeah, well, 40% is actually the amount that under state law, under Prop 98, the amount of state money that's supposed to go to schools anyway. But 40% would go to public education. So let's look at that. Suppose we raise $10 billion a year. That's $4 billion a year, not just $4 billion once. That's $4 billion a year going directly to public schools in California communities. The 60%, that's $6 billion a year going to communities. That could be used for example, building supportive housing for homeless people. It could be used to hire more doctors and nurses at public hospitals. It could be used for any of the things that cities and counties do and that we desperately need in this state right now. So it's big money, and it'll go to local government for local elected officials to decide how to spend.
Okay, that was my next question, is who will determine how this money is spent?
It will be the San Francisco Unified School District, for example, will decide whether to, for example, hire a lot more teachers, give the existing teachers raises, hire more paraprofessionals, build more school buildings. I mean, there's so many things that the San Francisco Unified School District needs, and it would be the school board that would decide, as they do now, how to allocate that budget. The same way it would be in San Francisco, where we are, it would be the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and the mayor who would decide how to allocate that money and what to allocate it to.
Final thoughts, Tim. I mean, you've been reporting on San Francisco politics for decades. You've seen how Prop 13 has really affected education. This would be a major, major change.
This is transformative to say. This is a game changer for California education. It's a very, very big deal. And, you know, in the pantheon of taxes that exist, obviously taxing corporate profits and rich people's wealth and income is the most progressive. But the next most progressive way of raising money for local communities is property taxes on big commercial property. Because these are folks who can afford to pay, and it's going to go to communities that really need it.
So again, Prop 15 would change the rules of Prop 13 by reassessing property taxes on commercial real estate. This would not apply to homeowners, farmland, or businesses with under $3 million in property. Prop 15 is being financed largely by the California Teachers Association, SEIU California, and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. They've spent a whopping $48 million so far. Supporters also include the California Democratic Party, Joe Biden, and California Governor Gavin Newsom. Those opposed to Prop 15 have spent $38 million so far. Major donors include the California Business Roundtable, the California Business Properties Association, and the California Taxpayers Association. Those opposed also include the California Chamber of Commerce, the California Retailers Association, and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Well, so much really changed across the country when Prop 13 was passed, and you can bet that people across the country are watching what is going to happen with Proposition 15. Tim Redmond has been a political and investigative reporter in San Francisco for more than 30 years. He spent much of that time as executive editor of the Bay Guardian. Tim is founder of 48 Hills. And if you are listening on KALW, we are doing a special 11 a.m. a special hour series on the California election. So Tim is going to stick around to stay with us to talk about the California State Senate race between Scott Wiener and Jackie Fielder. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.